Make it good.
So let's see. Trying to put together several studies on that we've had before, and to put them together and to do them on the topic of sin and what is sin and the nature of sin. There's various views available, I guess, in the church today. Some of which we tend to disagree with. That are tied in with a Reformed or Calvinist theology view. And we began to talk about this a few weeks ago, kind of came up in a larger study we were doing, and then we decided we should probably go back and kind of hit some of the more fundamental basic topics about sin. And first week, one of the things that came up was the concept of original sin, which is something that is a hand-me-down from Augustine and from Calvinism, which essentially states that all men, all babies, all children, any human being, as a result of being a descendant of Adam and Eve, is, from conception, guilty of sin and sinful, and possessing of something called a sinful nature, which in their definition typically means, to imply the other two things I stated, and also, or some sort of internal programming that will bring about sinful actions or choices inevitably.
And that sinful programming, again, results from the fact that Adam sinned, not...
And it's inherited from our parents. And so, if that is the case, then that has certain implications for what our understanding of sin is. In that case, a newborn baby has not sinned in the sense of transgressing the law of Moses or sinned in the sense of violating a command of Jesus Christ. It hasn't stolen anything, it hasn't committed any other form of sin as the laws or covenants have described it, but in Calvinism, nonetheless, babies are guilty of sin. And so there's a sense in which sin under Calvinism is defined in a way that is not related to actions or words or thoughts or behaviors or choices, not in regard to laws or commands, but in regard to something you inherit, which is just a conceptual reality for babies. And so to begin to tackle that issue in the larger scheme of the issue of what is sin and how can we define and understand what sin is, we started last week with the issue of the age of accountability to deal with this topic of children and whether or not they're guilty. And we just started with some biblical indications that sort of compare the situation of children to Adam and Eve and sort of give us some information along with our look at Cain from the week before and comparing him to Adam that show that, biblically speaking, God has revealed that he does not hold babies to be guilty of sin. He does not view babies to be sinful or sinners. They are viewed as innocent and good, and I just want to review some of that information, and of course that will have implications on the question of what is sin. So first I want to say that the Bible relates that Adam and Eve's awareness and shame of their nakedness was connected to their knowledge of good and evil. Their having committed sin and their knowledge of good and evil was related in some sense to their awareness of their nakedness. This is something that is present in children. This lack of concern for not being clothed. The Bible uses this awareness and shame of nakedness to indicate guilt of sin, even in the New Testament, to go along with what it says about Adam and Eve in Genesis 3, 2 Corinthians 5, 2, Revelation 3, 18, and 16, 15, all use the idea of nakedness as an awareness of nakedness as a reference or a metaphor to indicate knowledge of sin and guilt. So the Bible relates that knowledge of good and evil is something that is not present in children until a certain age of development. Isaiah 7, verse 14 and 16 talks about a child that will be born and that something will happen in the history and the people of Israel prior to the point in time where that child is able to know the difference and choose between good and evil, which is in using the same language of the tree of knowledge of good and evil and Adam and Eve in Genesis 3. Here being applied to children to indicate, along with this lack of concern about nakedness, that children, up until a certain point in development, do not have an inherent understanding of good and evil the way that God gave and discusses this regarding Adam and Eve. And this indicates, and this will be the last point I make on this, in accordance with what Jesus says in the New Testament in passages where he talks about how the kingdom is given like unto little children, you have to become like little children, and particularly passages that indicate that in the Old Testament there were periods where people sacrificed their children to idols, that it says that they sacrificed innocent blood. That's an attestation both from the Old and New Testament that children are viewed as innocent in God's eyes. And so, Brian, what were you going
to
add?
I just wanted to sort of underscore that when we see this language about children, and we also talk sort of conceptually about children and their awareness of nakedness and the idea of nakedness and awareness of it is guilt, that it's not just that the children don't have knowledge of sin until a certain age, or knowledge of good and evil until a certain age. That's true. But the lack of awareness of shame in the sense of nakedness is a lack of the acquisition of guilt and a lack of awareness of the guilt, because it wasn't until Adam and Eve sinned that they were aware that they were naked, and that became a metaphor for their acquisition of guilt and their conscious awareness of their guilt. So for children not to have that is in biblical terms would suggest that they're neither guilty nor aware of guilt.
Yeah. Well, we did...
Just real quick, we were talking about nakedness in that sense. Is it when he said metaphorical, I just want to make sure I understand, isn't that being naked in and of itself is sinful? It's the realization that you're uncovered, or the shame, or the guilt of knowing that they knew that at that point in time their eyes were open, they knew they had done something wrong, and they couldn't hide themselves. Is that the part that...
Well, it certainly begins to be related to that concept of being covered, but I think what God is attempting to do is to convey certain truths or facts or realities to us through this associated thing, which is awareness of nakedness, which we see present in children and was in the case of Adam and Eve in the garden. So
I would say that the Bible seems to be not only using the awareness of physical nakedness as a sort of metaphor, but it's also linking up the real awareness of physical nakedness with a simultaneous corresponding awareness of guilt, that those two things were correspondent, and the one became a metaphor for the other, but it's not as though there is no real other corresponding thing that goes along with it. I mean, it is there really is the idea that Adam and Eve put on clothing because they are aware that they are guilty and they are somehow vulnerable and deserving of punishment. And those two things, that whatever triggered that also triggered their awareness of nakedness. It was the same sort of wrapped up together in that same faculty of the brain affected both of those things at the same time.
Some kind of indicators to us that of an awareness for
to answer your first question though, being naked in itself is not a sin.
You're
gonna take a shower, bath, you're fine.
Well, I'm gonna pin it for myself later. Anyway, I understand.
Last week we also took some time to look at a couple passages in Psalms, chapter 51 and Psalm 58 as well, that can be taken or have been taken from time to time to indicate that children are considered sinful or guilty of sin from conception or birth. Psalm 51:5 says, David says, "I was formed in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me." We made the argument that it should be at least considered whether or not this is a statement, if you read the larger context, of David making a plea to God for mercy because of sin he's committed, and citing the fact that he's been surrounded by sinners and in the presence of sinful examples his entire life, and therefore that he's picked up this trait, or that he's picked up this behavior from his environment, that he's saying, look, I've essentially been in a bad environment the whole time. Yes, I fell into the trap, but... have mercy on me, rather than saying, I know that you hold me guilty from the fact that I was born from Adam, so have mercy on me because I was guilty in conception.
I think the key term there would be learned behavior from the environment, rather than inherited traits from an ancestor.
So I think we can get into that passage more further on, but last week I think we just wanted to initially show that it doesn't necessitate the conclusion that babies are considered sinful from conception.
There's at least two options.
Yeah, and same with Psalm 58:3 that says the wicked go astray from the womb as soon as they are born. We argued that, again, going astray indicates a movement away from something where you were before, which in this case would be with God. And so that we also discussed the possibility of some hyperbole here, that he may be indicating that they speak lies as soon as they are born, if that's the phraseology, if that's what it intends. And then really David's just talking about a long history of sin for particularly the wicked here, not attesting to this fact for the righteous, but for the wicked as he discriminates between the two, and that they stop up their ears, they don't start out deaf. So again, indicators that this passage may not mean what people have taken it to mean or taught it to mean sometimes. So did you have something you wanted to throw in there? Or
okay. No, I just the point is, I think you also use the Psalms as a whole instead of just pulling out these two as well. As another third point last week, other than logic and grammar.
Yeah, we're talking about how frequently throughout the Psalms David contrasts the wicked and the good, and also there's indications in both Psalms and Proverbs, sort of instructions against being a righteous man being carried away by his envy of the wicked, or his, you know, sort of reasoning in his own mind that they seem to be getting away with it. Why should I not sin? You know, so there seems to be that kind of awareness of the instruction from David elsewhere.
Wasn't the context of Psalm 58 there, like, wasn't it a plea for vengeance and, like, destruction upon these people that he's citing? And it would be awkward if he was meaning to also include himself, or like the righteous remnant, like
that's that contrast again that goes throughout most of the Psalms, frequently throughout the Psalms.
Yeah, like God's response would be, "So are you."
Well, I think what happens is it becomes pretty obvious that the Psalm was not initially intended by David to be a conceptual discussion of the state of all mankind from birth, but rather it was intended to be a very focused comment, pleading for God's anger against a very specific set of people, not the whole of mankind.
Well, and I didn't want to get back into a larger conclusive statement about Psalms. I just wanted to say that we had pointed out last week initially that those passages may not mean what they have sometimes been, might have been told, and we would need to look into that, and we can look into that further. The last thing is that just the implications of these things. Again, if children are considered guilty of sin and are considered sinful from conception or from birth, that has implications for the question, what is sin? If that is the case, then sin and guilt of sin are not really a violation of God's law or command, because as we pointed out, a newborn baby or an infant or a baby in its mother's womb is not committing a violation of any command or law that God has ever given. Instead, sin would have to be understood not as an action, a choice, or a belief, but it's something inherited from Adam and Eve, some kind of programming, some kind of original sin, some kind of birth defect, whatever you want to call it. But it is, and also you might think, if that's the case, then really what is sin is unknowable and undefinable. It's not defined by laws or commands or behaviors or by actions. It's some unknowable, undefinable thing. And I think that ties into this concept that many of us certainly experience or exposed to in the church in our growing up or in our past, which is that we all sin all the time without knowing it. That's, I think, a reflection of that idea that sin is some unknowable, undefinable thing that's not particularly tied to any action that you might say, oh, I just did this or I didn't that, I'm sinning, but just you're always in sin. Just accept it and move on humbly.
It becomes almost like some sort of vague descriptor rather than like a defined action.
Yeah, it's like a...
Every day you can make a numerous...
Or I think...
Innumerable.
And by the way, I think this point which you made last week that we're talking about now is... whether or not we go on to prove it obviously lays ahead, but... then at least it's important to recognize at the beginning that conceptually, when you talk about a baby or a child that's not been born yet being sinful, you really have a radically different definition of what sin is, because you're not talking about a choice or a thought or an emotion or a response or anything. You're talking about just a state that's in some sense almost tied to the material itself, that's transmitted down from Adam to his offspring. And in that sense, I think you get really into the sort of Gnostic origins of it. But in any case, it's still important to recognize that you have to be defining sin in a very different way. I just think that needs to be understated, restated, because that's really important.
Okay. We talked about conversely, passages like Ezekiel, or maybe it was Exodus, I think it might have been Ezekiel, where God says that I do not hold children guilty for the sins of their parents. I don't punish children for the sins of their parents. And there's a statement in Deuteronomy to that effect as well. And that has implications. If children are not guilty of sin, babies are not considered guilty of sin, or sinful beings, or sinners, then that has implications for what sin is. It implies, I think, that sin and guilt require the ability to know and understand what is wrong, and then the choice to do so. And that knowledge of what is wrong, as we'll see, can come from various places, but it has to be something that is available to the individual that is considered guilty of sin, that they have to have had some ability to know what they were doing when they did it. And so we'll talk about that further, but that'll bring us up to where we're going to start tonight, which is going to talk about this issue of where does knowledge of sin come from? How do we define sin? And we're going to learn some things about this. In fact, one of the things that I found interesting that was not something we were taught growing up is that the nature or the definition or the allowance of what is sin or what is prohibited as sinful has changed at different points in time over the course of biblical history. God has at one point said one thing, and then later said, so at one point he might say, you can do this, and then later he'll say, you can't do that anymore. Or it might go the other way.
When you say this, you mean, you are now talking about sin on a line item level, like a list of things that are considered. That list changes over time. But you're not talking about a change in the general definition of sin, which is to behave contrary to some standard. That general definition doesn't really change.
Right, the specifics.
The specific sin list, what is and isn't on that list, changes over time.
Yeah. So I want to, again, start back in Genesis 4. We looked at this I think maybe 2 weeks ago when we talked about Cain and the circumstances of Cain and Adam, and how God treated them both the same before they sinned and both the same after they sinned, showing that God did not treat Cain guilty of sin before he sinned. Instead, he was treated the way Adam was treated before Adam sinned. But if we turn to Genesis 4, in the verses that cover the point right before Cain kills Abel, we have God make this statement. He says, if thou do well, shalt thou not be accepted. And if you don't do well, sin lies at the door. And what I want to point out here is when we see God conversing with Cain, it seems pretty clear that God is intending to warn Cain about something, some kind of consequence, to admonish him to do what's right. It's very brief. It's not very long. The statements don't seem to include a great deal of explanation. But somehow I think you get the sense from this that God expected Cain knew what he was saying. That God didn't expect Cain walking away scratching his head going, what is sin? What is he talking about? What am I not doing right? That God's expectation here, even from the brevity of his remarks, seemed to be that Cain was astute enough to grasp that he was entertaining doing something or heading in the wrong direction, and that he knew what that would be, and that God was warning him or pointing him or reminding him of the consequences of that. And I think that this tells us something about the nature of sin and what is sin. And I think we can ask the question, how is it that Cain is expected to know or knows what is sinful? Prior to this point, what was the sum total of commands that had been given? You got another point. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Probably from the knowing from the parents.
From the parents. What would Cain be able to pick up from his parents that would inform him about this situation?
He obviously knows they're not in contact with God.
Yeah, he certainly seems to get what the... I think you could at least say that Cain was able to grasp what the consequence was. But there seems to be some sense that God expects... I mean, it's no good to just tell a kid, look, if you do the wrong thing here, you're going to be grounded. The kid also has to know what the wrong thing is, otherwise they may do it and then have to get grounded without realizing they did what was wrong. So I think it's implicit here that God expects that Cain knows what wrong is in some sense and enough to avoid it. So I think
it really, in order for this to have the impact, you have to use some term that no one's familiar with in a sentence, and then expect them to sort of understand what that term is. You know, because you say sin or wrong, we already have those defined. But the equivalent for Cain would be if God just used some word that he'd never heard before, and then Cain was supposed to go, "What the heck is that?" Like,
so the reason that Brian's saying that is that this is the that in this verse, Genesis 4:7, is the first time the word sin actually appears in the Bible. It doesn't appear in Genesis 3 with Adam and Eve. It's the first time it appears here. Now, it appears numerous times after this throughout the Law of Moses. Certainly any Israelite from the time of Moses and afterward reading this passage or hearing this passage from Genesis 4 would know what sin at least conceptually meant. But how did Cain know? God doesn't start out in Genesis 3 going, "Okay, look, I'm going to throw a concept at you. Sin. I'm going to define it for you. It means not doing the things that I expect you to do, or doing things that I told you not to do." He doesn't define it anywhere like that. There's only one thing that is told before this that they can't do, which is to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And yet, right after that happens, God expects that Cain knows that he shouldn't kill Abel, or that he shouldn't be angry without cause, or whatever you might construe the problem is that Cain is heading in the wrong direction that God's trying to warn him about.
Even if it's as basic as God saying, "You know that when people do something wrong, I will punish them for it." And then God says, "So I'm warning you. Like, I know what's going on, and I'm warning you to be careful about what you proceed to do next." Without even mentioning, as he doesn't mention murder, he doesn't mention being angry with Abel. He's just saying that concept here is very much something you need to be worried about right now.
Yeah, and we'll let Paul explain this for us later as we go forward, but I wanted to pull this verse out to show that there's this expectation again here. Before Cain has sinned himself, God is treating Cain as Cain's in his presence. He's conversing with the Lord just as Adam did before Adam sinned. And then, of course, after Cain sins, he's expelled from the presence of the Lord just as Adam was after he had sinned. And so very early on here, we'll see, I think Paul will do a much better job explaining some of this to us.
Do you think in a nutshell that Cain, God's used the word sin without any contextual explanation to Cain, at least shows that at most Cain would have been able to say, "I know when my parents did something contrary to the will of God, that they were punished for it," and that Cain would have understood the word sin to mean to do something contrary to the will of God that would then result in punishment.
I think at least that much is implied here, and I think...
And his model for that at least would have been a scenario where his parents had a command given to them.
Yeah, in that case for sure, but both the case of Adam and Cain, or Adam and Eve and Cain, God seems to expect that both parties, when we group them into group one as Adam and Eve and group two as Cain, that both of those parties somehow knew enough to know what was inappropriate. In the case of Adam and Eve, it was because he told them, "Don't eat of this tree."
Oh, I see. You're emphasizing the idea that it's important. The important component is that there's no idea of sin, that you don't have any basis to already understand what it is, you know, like this modern notion that there's all kinds of sins that we commit.
I want to communicate that.
What we're doing
wrong. So if you'll skip down, I want to skip a few parts, some specific stuff there I don't want to cover, just to this here. So God accepts or rejects us on the basis of what is sinful. I think that's true. I think that's what the Bible communicates. Now, in Calvinism, you might argue that God doesn't really accept us or reject us on the basis of what is sinful. He accepts us or rejects us solely based upon Christ's atoning work without regard for whether we're sinful or not, or whether we repent or not, or whether we believe or not. It's something that God does. But I think that, biblically speaking, the issue of what is sinful is crucial to whether we're accepted. And so I think you need to figure out as humans, okay, if that's important, if I sin and God rejects me and I need to repent of sin to be obedient and to gain the forgiveness that Christ offers, then I probably ought to try to figure out if God has communicated what sin is and then steer clear of that. And so that's going to be an important question as we go forward is, how do we know what God considers sinful?
I remember way back when somebody was doing a study on Islam, and they mentioned the Islamic term shirk, and the sort of phrase was, "Don't commit shirk." You know, and if I said in this room, like, "Look, you're going to be cool with God as long as you don't commit shirk," like, I think a lot of people would be leaving this room going, "I've got to figure out what shirk is," right? And so that would be the sort of situation that Cain or anybody would be in if there was not a basis provided to them to already define what sin was. They would be the guy walking out of the room going, I better not do it, but I don't have any idea what it is. Like, I really just don't even understand what the term means.
So first and foremost, I think that what's the most obvious way that people came to a knowledge of what is sinful? What would be the most obvious way that someone might get information about that?
Back then?
Would be, yeah.
God.
From God? Okay.
Straight from...
So in Adam and Eve's case, don't eat from the tree.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Don't eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Straight from God. What's a more elaborate version of that? The most elaborate version of that? It's more clearly, what is that?
Law of Moses?
Law of Moses, there we go. Yeah. I figured in a group like this you'd get an answer there.
Yeah,
the Law of Moses, right? I mean, if you're an Israelite living at the time of the Exodus or after that, you want to know what sinful is? You go look at these four books that Moses wrote, starting with Exodus, and you've got a long list of reading to do, and by the time you're done with that, you're going to have a long list of things you can do and a lot of things you have to do and a lot of things you can't do. And that's a great way to define what sin is. That whole book is a series of this is not good, this is sin, you're going to be put to death for this, don't do it, blah, blah, blah. It says as much in Exodus as God tells Moses to tell the people, this is my covenant, you must keep all of the commands and the teachings that I have set before you these day. All the decrees, all the laws. And so that the Law of Moses, or as an example of God verbally, specifically declaring his rules of what is and isn't sin, defining it for us explicitly. Now, the Law of Moses has one advantage over Adam. What happened with Adam and Eve, what is that? Don kind of mentioned it in his first response. What is more advantageous about the Law of Moses than what happened with Adam and Eve?
It's a lot more explicit.
More explicit and
it's written down.
It's written down. God does not come down to the Garden of Eden and go, I'm going to write just a small stone here. I'm going to write this small code on this tiny rock. Put it right next to this particular tree. Don't eat this. You know. But in the Law of Moses, God writes it down and they preserve it and they put it in an important place within their tribes, in their kingdom, in a vault, essentially.
So you're saying the difference between it being written down versus it just being verbally told, maybe even just to one person, is... you get about five people deep or whoever, how many people deep, and the verbal message could have been distorted along the way, whereas an original written document helps to preserve.
Yeah. So the Law of Moses is a covenant, and like all contracts, I think contract is our more modern term for the more antiquated term covenant, it has a set of rules for parties that are engaged in or bound to that covenant or contract to participate in. The things that disqualify you. If you buy a house, you have a contract with the house, and you have to pay the bank. If you don't pay the bank a number of months in a row, you forfeit the house, they seize it, stuff like that. All kinds of contracts, work contracts, have rules and requirements for what is considered to be a violation, and then under some circumstances, the termination of the contract and the termination of benefits set forth in that contract to both parties. So the Law of Moses is essentially a legal arrangement between God and the people of Israel. If you do this, I'm going to bless you. If you violate my laws and you sin against me, I'm going to curse you. You're going to be kicked out of my land. You're going to be kicked out of my presence. You're going to suffer. You're going to struggle. Very similar, as we said, to the circumstance with Adam and Eve. Once they sin, they are kicked out of God's presence and they have to work. They go under the authority of at least these sin, as God says to Cain, sin lies at the door. Adam and Eve have been pushed, they've been kicked out the door, and now they're forced by these cherubim to stay away from God.
I think, obviously the New Testament refers to the Law of Moses as this sort of tutor to instruct us and prepare us for Christ, which I know you're going to talk about later. But as you think about how the Israelites would have understood sin from the time of Moses forward, it's very difficult to imagine that your average Israelite would have conceived of the possibility that there was some other things that they did throughout their daily life that may or may not have been sin besides what was explicitly testified to in the Law of Moses. Like that they would have thought, it's everything in the Law of Moses plus a bunch of vague other stuff that we don't really have written down and wasn't stated that we may or may not be doing anyway.
Yeah.
Because that would have been a really horrible way for that contract to work, for God to say, here's all the rules, follow them, you stay in the land. If you break them, then I'm going to kick you out of the land and punish you. Plus a bunch of other stuff that, you know, I really haven't, I'm not including here, but I will do the same thing for those other things.
And one thing is, seems to be the case with the Law of Moses, is that by painstakingly taking the time to write down this large number of ordinances and decrees in very specific detail, and all of us know that if we've tried to read through the books of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, at some point you're like, I just want to finish these books and move on to something more interesting. But the implication of God taking the time to write that all down in detail is that that's all the detail you need. There's not like some other set of stuff that also is just as important, but God just was like, I'm tired of writing. I got a cramp in my hand. I'm not going to keep writing all the other stuff. You get it. But it's the same thing here. Like, you think about modern day. In the United States, we have the Constitution, we have amendments, we have various state and federal ordinances and laws on the books that are upheld and put on there by Congress, our state and local Congress as well. There's not a bunch of other things that are also violations of our law that are not on the books. It's what's on the books that is the definition of the violation of the law. There's no police officer could pull you over and go, you're under arrest. For what? What law am I breaking? Well, you've done a bunch of things wrong. I'm not even going to tell you. I can't even, where do I start it? There's just a ton of things you're doing wrong all the time. You're under arrest. That's not how it works. And that's not how it worked on the Law of Moses. And that's not how Israelites would have conceived of it. Does anybody know here how many laws, commands there were in the Law of Moses? Somebody has actually done this count.
600 something.
If you go through the books of Moses and you remove the redundancies, because there are recapitulations of them, you will count, according to Jewish reckoning, 613 commandments. That's a lot. There's not some other 5,000 unwritten commandments somewhere that God just kind of basically goes, you know what, this is pointless, you're all sinning all the time, I'm not even going to bother. The 613 were what was necessary to communicate to them what he did accept and what he didn't, and what he thought was sinful and what he didn't.
I think another critical component, which we've already kind of talked about, is the conditional nature of the covenant. It was an if-then statement, right? So if you kept it, you'd get the rewards. If you didn't keep it, you'd get kicked out. Well, if there's a bunch of unstated conditions, that contract is useless, and because you could break stuff that wasn't stated, get kicked out of the land, or, you know, it would, and even then, the stuff that was stated might be equally as irrelevant as some of the things that weren't stated. So it has to be only what's stated that's part of it in order for it to work. And the other thing is, you know, we've talked about in other passages in the Old Testament where God's saying, look, don't add to this and don't subtract from this.
Right.
So if you can't make that statement, don't add to it, don't subtract from it, if there's also a bunch of other unstated things that haven't been literally told to the people of Israel, but should be included in their understanding of what sin is.
Right. Yeah. And when ultimately the people of Israel are punished for violations, it's for violations of things that are actually written in that law code. It's not for a bunch of things that aren't. It's for specific things that God told about in the law code. So the point we're making here again in large is that sin and guilt of sin specifically is dependent upon the ability of the person who's considered guilty to understand essentially what right and wrong is, to have gained that information. Now, if you have a note in your house on your wall that says, hey, kids have to be at home at dark, and it's on the wall and everybody can see it and it's been pointed out, but the kids just ignore it, or one kid just doesn't bother reading the notes that you put up on the thing every season, it's summertime, you still have to be home by dark, the kid could still be guilty even if they don't know about it, because it's there. They know there's a note board. They know they're supposed to look on it. But the point I'm making is that if it's expected, or it can be expected, that you should understand what right and wrong is, and the rules have been published somewhere or made known to you somehow, that is important to defining if someone is sinning and is guilty of sin. This is very different than in the Calvinist scheme of it, and so I think it's important to point it out. So it's easy to look at the Law of Moses as this great example of what sin is, and not just in their case, what specific things were sin, but how God communicates what sin is to us. But we ask the question, well, Moses didn't come until 3,000 years into history, according to biblical reckoning, after Adam. So before that time, you didn't have the Law of Moses. How did men know what sin was? How did they get this information? And again, ultimately, Paul's going to help us with this in Romans. But I just want to throw out there that there are other places where God provides do's and don'ts. I'll give you one that most people probably don't think about. What does God say to Adam and Eve they can eat? He says, all dominion is given to you over the fowl of the earth, blah, blah, blah. And then he says, I have given you this day to eat all the herb of the tree and the fruit of the, all the, any vegetation, right? No, he doesn't say don't eat blah, 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 blah. The only thing he says they can't eat is from the tree of knowledge. But there's an implication there that the things that they are to eat are the vegetation. Now, the reason that I can say this is because when you go to Genesis 9, after the flood, when you get to Noah and his sons, God says similarly to them, be fruitful, multiply, finish the earth. I've given you all these things, every moving thing. And then he says in verse 3, in contrast to what he told Adam and Eve in Genesis 1, he says, every moving thing that lives will be meat for you, even as the green herb I have given you all things. So now he's changing this from what he did with Adam and Eve to a new circumstance. With Adam and Eve, he said, you can only eat the herbs. You can only eat the fruit of the tree, essentially, the green things. But to Noah and his sons, he says, yes, just as I had previously said, you can eat anything from the tree, any vegetation, I'm also telling you now that you can eat animals. You can eat flesh. You can eat meat. And so there's a change here in what was allowed and versus what wasn't allowed previously in these two cases. And so there's a set of rules here that's being given to Noah and his sons that differs in some respects from the previous scenario prior to the flood that hadn't goes all the way back to the time of Adam. And so in verse 6 here, he says, I'll start with verse 5. He says, surely your blood, let me start in verse 4, I suppose I should, but flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, you shall not eat. So they're not allowed to consume any flesh that has not been drained of the blood. This goes on into the law of Moses as well. But he gives the reason. He says, surely your blood of your own lives will I require at the hand of every beast I will require it, and at the hand of every man, at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of a man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. And then he goes on to talk about them being fruitful and multiplying and this covenant that he's given him here. So there's another change that happens here that most of us probably haven't thought about before, that I hadn't thought about before this. Anybody know, what did I just read that God is telling Noah and his sons regarding violations of this particular rule? What if somebody kills a person?
They're required to be killed themselves.
Yeah. He's saying if man kills someone, by man will his blood be shed. So if there's a murderer among you, you guys are authorized to go and to kill or punish that murderer by putting them to death.
Mm-hmm. Or with Cain, that was out.
That's the point that I want to make. Thank you, Don.
You're welcome.
Prior to this, Cain, first instance of man being killed, Cain kills Abel, right? Cain's worried. He's like, no, later it's Lamech that's worried. But God says, look, I don't want any man killing Cain.
Cain's word too. Cain says, whoever stumbles upon me is going to kill me.
Yeah, and God says, nope, nobody kill Cain. Don't anybody touch him. I'm gonna make Cain a mark on Cain so that you know you can't kill Cain. And what God is saying in that case, which is contrasted to this here, is God, prior to the time of Noah, prior to the flood, did not authorize men to commit capital punishment upon murderers. It was not authorized for men to do that. After the flood, now he says, if someone kills someone, you put them to death. That's the rule. And also, you can eat meat. Changing the rule. In a covenant form here. Very similar to what happens with Adam and Eve. So this is a set of rules here. It's pretty broad. Doesn't have a lot of other things in here in terms of detailed things.
So it sounds like there's like, what, two or three in here, not 613.
There's not 613. There are other things that I think, as we turn to the New Testament, that Paul will explain that God expected Noah and his sons, and even people before the flood, to know from other sources besides God specifically saying, hey, don't kill somebody. I don't expect that I have to tell you not to kill somebody for you to know not to kill somebody. He didn't expect to have to tell Cain, don't kill Abel, but he expected Cain knew that he shouldn't. And there's reasons for that, and Paul explains it in Romans 1 and 2, and I won't do that myself because I think Paul does a better job. So the covenant with Noah is one source prior to the time of Moses where we get laws. Also, the time of Adam is a source prior to that. Now, we've seen some changes, and we'll continue to talk about that. Another source is Abraham. What's some first thing you think about with Abraham that happens that had not happened prior to that? It's the most circumcision. None of Adam was not formed out of the ground circumcised. He was not. He was not. That's the whole point. None of us come out that way. He institutes this with Abraham. Now, at the time of Abraham, once this happens, you could not inherit from Abraham or be a part of that covenant that was made with Abraham that would go forward to the Jewish people and ultimately to Christ and then to us. You could not, at the time of Abraham, participate in that as a male unless you were circumcised. Prior to that, Noah inherited the floods. Noah, after the flood, and his sons all inherited the earth, but none of them were circumcised. God did not require it. Adam had dominion over the earth, not circumcised. Abraham, got to be circumcised. Time of Moses, it's continued. The circumcision requirement is continued under Moses so that you could not inherit the promise of Abraham as a Jewish man or as a foreigner who's converted unless you had been circumcised. Obviously a change from the way God set it up in the natural order.
So I think part of the reason, like at the core, one of the things you're tracking tonight is this question of, is sin such a thing as that we're all sinning in various ways and we don't even know what they are and it's hard to define and we're just sinful? Or is knowledge a key component of what sin is, such that if you have to have a sufficient amount of knowledge of what sin is? You have to be able to properly define it. God has provided knowledge of it in various ways, and that you can't really be counted guilty if there's not been any information about it. But that's not how those covenants work. And when you talk about the change from one to another, the focus there is on the list, that the list of sins from one covenant differs necessarily from the list of sins in another. They're not always the same, which means it's really important to know what the list is.
Right. Well, and notice this. When God comes to Abraham, he doesn't go to Abraham and go, "Okay, Abraham, do you know what I'm about to say?" And Abraham's, "Yeah, I've got to get circumcised, right? That's how it's going to go." God informs him of this very significant change from the way it was before. When he goes to Noah and his sons, he says, he doesn't go, "Guess what you can eat now? You already know this. Meat, that's right." He informs them of it. They don't intuit it. It's not like this was common knowledge and they had it. God has to inform them of the new situation. And he does it with the law of Moses, too. There's a set of new laws, set of things that are now going into effect that are enjoined upon these people. And so God has made it clear through at every point in time that in order to be sinful and guilty of sin, he is going to provide a means of informing you that you can know what this is and that you ought to know and that you will be held accountable for actions in regard to that. Now,
and therefore can avoid it because it's been made.
And now we'll go on to talk about how there are other ways besides direct verbal commandments, such as the law of Moses, or don't eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, or what he says to Noah or to Abraham. There's other ways that God informs us besides a verbal command. But verbal commands are the easiest one to point out, and I'm trying to use this to show that knowledge and awareness and understanding of what is wrong and the ability to avoid it based upon that knowledge is part and parcel of defining what sin is at any given time.
I also think, like, if you track through Adam and Eve with the tree of knowledge, and if you go forward even to Cain, but even also to the declarations to Noah, to Abraham, to Moses, the purpose of God telling you what sin is, of him making that known and declaring it, is so that you'll avoid it. And that implies that it's that God wants you to avoid it, and that human beings should be able to try to avoid sin. Otherwise, if we're going to be sinning all the time and it doesn't matter, then these declarations of a list of sins are they're almost purposeless, because contrary to the stated purpose of God, don't eat from this tree so that you won't eat from this tree. You know, don't kill another man so that I won't have to have you put to death for it. You know, there's the intent to tell us, to give us knowledge so that we can't avoid it.
Yeah. So The New Testament has some comments to make on this, which essentially confirm what we're saying about the nature of sin. Sin is a violation of the law that God has set up right now. Whatever the rule is right now, that is sin is a violation of those things. So the New Testament upholds the idea or definition that sin is essentially a violation of law, and the way we might think of it is a crime. Romans 4:15 says this, where there is no law, there's no transgression. If there isn't a law, then there's nothing you're doing in violation of a law, and there's nothing you're doing that would be sinful. Word transgression here being a word used often to discuss sin.
I think the important thing there is that when there is no stated standard, that God, in some sense, is not going to count you as violating that standard.
If there's no expected understanding of it because there hasn't been some declaration. Romans 5:13, Paul says, for until the law, sin was in the world, but sin is not counted when there is no law. It's not counted. Why? Because although men were doing things that were wrong, in this case they're doing things that were wrong, not because of a verbal command or statement. I realize Brian's not scrolling down to where I'm at, but I'm just reading short verses. That there are other ways that we can know about it, but in this case, God had not enjoined any particular law on the people. Now, if you were, like I said, if you were at the time of Abraham and you were in Abraham's household, this law applied to you. And Paul will go on to talk about this earlier in Romans, where he's talking about essentially Gentiles were not under the law of Moses. They weren't. The Gentiles living in foreign nations were not under the law of Moses. The law of Moses was a law for the people of Israel, the descendants of Abraham. Now, he says that the Gentiles are still guilty, even though the law of Moses was not to them in their nation contractually, they're still guilty, and he gives us some other ways by which God expects people to know. But here, I think, just supporting the idea that sin is a violation of some kind of law. Now, in the case of Gentiles, they're guilty of violations of things that they could have known prior to the law of Moses, is what Paul essentially will argue. From revelations and experience and history and things that were made known prior to Moses, even if they're not bound to the law of Moses, as he puts it. So we'll get to that
when we talk about other sources of knowledge besides the stated command. We're still talking about sin as something that can be known and defined. We're never talking about it as something so abstract or so frequent that it's occurring all the time without us being able to detect it, or identify it, and avoid it.
Yeah. And the last verse I want to read is from 1 John 3:4, where he says, whoever commits sin transgresses also the law, for sin is the transgression of the law. So I'm going to stop here this week. Next week we're going to get into this other issue of how can men be considered sinful if there is no law, because Paul says that prior to the law there was sin in the world, even though there was not the law of Moses yet. And then as we look at this in Romans 1 and 2, we'll see that Paul identifies for us that there are other ways and sources that God has given us to be able to determine what sin is besides simply a written law code or verbal command, but nonetheless, he believes are clear delineations. Again, tying in this concept that in order for something to be considered sinful, it has to be revealed to be sinful. It can't be some, as Brian said, abstract, unidentifiable thing. It's an identifiable thing that you can reason to and understand, and that knowing that you can do that, God holds you accountable for that.
And we'll see Paul use the phrase, therefore men are without excuse. Because even when he's talking about other sources of knowledge of sin besides the law of Moses, he's still declaring that it's possible to know and define what sin is, and that's what deprives men of the excuse. Because the excuse would be, there was no way to know that was going to be something God was going to be angry with us about.
Yeah.
And Paul's like, no, you could have known. There's always a way to know.
Yeah, and so if understanding what is sinful is a prerequisite for defining what is sin, then sin cannot be something unknowable. It's pretty simple. So anyway, we'll drop there for tonight, and then next week we'll pick it up again, and I will stop the recording.